stopped because I've got a lump in my throat.
Welcome to the greatest events in sporting history. I'm Shane Thomas. My guest host today, returning to the podcast, is Christina Fryer, or Dr. Christina Fryer. Christina, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me again.
Glad to be here. The event we're going to be talking about today is something new for the podcast. I think me and Jonathan have said before that one thing we've never covered and didn't think we ever would is horse racing. Not because of some animosity towards the sport, but we both know next to nothing about it. So we never thought it's something we'd ever be able to cover. However, luckily, we have someone who does know something about horse racing. Myself and Christina, mainly Christina, will be talking about American Pharoah and his achievement in 2015 winning the Triple Crown. Christina, first off, can you explain to me and listeners what is the Triple Crown?
So the Triple Crown is a series of three horse races in the U.S., and they are the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes, and the Belmont Stakes. To win the Triple Crown is to win all three of these in the same year, and it is an accomplishment that is quite rare. So there have been 13 winners of the Triple Crown, starting in 1919 with a series of horses that are relatively unremarkable in terms of, I mean, they weren't unremarkable, but horses that we don't really know about that aren't sort of cultural icons. The one whose name is semi-familiar, and I can't say a lot about it, but War Admiral. If you watch a lot of horse racing in the U.S., you will hear the name War Admiral every now and then. There's a horse that wins the Triple Crown in 1919. There are a few horses that win in the 1930s and 1940s. And then a bit of a gap between 1948 and 1973. And then in 1973, we have probably the most famous horse, Secretariat,
which if anyone's heard of that horse, it's basically because they made a movie about it a few years ago.
Or if you are an American, you may have heard about Secretariat prior to the movie because of his accomplishment in the third race, the Belmont. There's just a very famous piece of sporting footage that involves Secretariat. So some Americans would have known who he was prior to the movie. So that was 1973. Then you have Seattle Sloan, 1977, affirmed in 1978. And then a very long gap, 37 years to 2015 with American Pharoah. There are a few things that are important about the Triple Crown. First of all, we'll start with the Kentucky Derby. And the Kentucky Derby is in Kentucky, as the name suggests. I would say it's a cultural moment in the U.S. calendar, and not just the U.S. Sports calendar, but the U.S. sort of cultural calendar. It's not uncommon for people to have Kentucky Derby parties. You know, you'd be at somebody's house, or they would definitely make mint juleps, which is an alcoholic beverage, unless, of course, this is an event where people are not drinking. There'd probably be hats. We don't have as much of a hat-wearing culture in the U.S. As the U.K. does, although, of course, there is a black tradition of, in particular, church hats. But the Kentucky Derby is a moment when people would perhaps wear hats to a party or to an event, or if they were going to the actual to Churchill Downs, which is the track, they would certainly be wearing hats. So the Kentucky Derby in particular is just a cultural moment in the U.S. calendar.
It feels like, to use a British analog, kind of your version of the Grand National, because I've heard of the Kentucky Derby, even though I know nothing.
Yeah.
I think most people have heard of the Kentucky Derby in some way ever. And I mean, I don't think there's like Grand National parties over here, but the Grand National is something that people, like, it's not uncommon for like office sweepstakes on Grand National weekend and on like Saturdays, because the Grand National's on a Saturday, on BBC Radio, which when they're normally broadcasting the live football, it's not uncommon for them to break away from the football to go to the live to the Grand National for, you know, the 5-10 minutes how long the race is.
And I would say in a way it actually combines the Grand National with Royal Ascot in that
clothing and the hats tradition and stuff.
That's
definitely an Ascot thing.
That combination of sort of a social calendar event as well as then this is a moment in which, you know, we tend not to have office sweepstakes in that same way. We tend to have more brackets and American football pools. There probably wouldn't be office betting around the Kentucky Derby, although, of course, it is horse racing, so this is a sport that does involve a lot of gambling. But it sort of combines the two. The local news, the national news would reveal or would, you know, at some point say who had won the Kentucky Derby. And in terms of coverage, talking about breaking away from regular events, these three events get a lot of coverage on, I think it's NBC that's still doing it. I believe it was ABC when I was growing up. All three of these events will get 3-4 hour blocks on NBC afternoon time. You know, that typical way that you get a lot of padding with the sort of big American sports showcase events. It's taking up a fair amount of the television of the day, the Saturday. Some other things that are important about the Triple Crown, these events come in a pretty rapid succession. So the Kentucky Derby is the first Saturday in May. This, again, gets back to this issue of it being part of the U.S. social calendar. It's not quite the start of the summer. I think Memorial Day weekend tends to be the traditional start of summer in the U.S., and that includes, of course, the Indianapolis 500. But this is sort of one of those run-up events to summer. Summer is on its way. In a certain way, if the Kentucky Derby, when the Kentucky Derby comes around.
Kind of like the first, well, I'd say, blockbuster, normally the first superhero movie of the year.
Kind
of indicates, okay, well, like, it's getting warmer.
Yeah, so it's definitely in that. So first Saturday in May, spring is here, depending on where you are. Because depending on where you are in the country, when I was living in Buffalo, it was not always clear if spring was here in the first Saturday of May. But the Kentucky Derby sort of symbolizes that. So first Saturday in May is the Kentucky Derby. Then 2 weeks later is the Preakness Stakes. The Preakness Stakes is in Baltimore, Maryland. And then 3 weeks after the Preakness, so whatever that tends to be either the first or the second Saturday in June, is the Belmont Stakes. And the Belmont Stakes is in New York State, near New York City, but outside it, in a place called Elmont, New York. So they come in relatively rapid succession. And why the Triple Crown is such a big deal is the other really important thing to know about the Triple Crown. Horse racing in general, the big races tend not to have an age maximum. I imagine the Grand National doesn't. And then there's another big race in the U.S. called the Breeders' Cup Classic that happens in the fall, and that does not have an age maximum. So basically, horses hit their peak around 5, 4, 5, 6, 7.
The Grand National, a few years ago, they set a minimum age.
Yes, that would not, yeah, that does not surprise
but
me.
But yeah, but not like a maximum age.
What is the minimum age?
7 years.
The minimum age of the Grand National is 7?
Yeah, the horses need to be 7 years old.
That is amazing. Yeah, so that tells a tale, actually. That is really, that's really interesting information. So Grand National minimum age is 7, and that's, am I correct in saying that that's the biggest horse race in the English calendar?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you're a racing fan, then, you know, there's other horses. So, like, there's a Cheltenham Festival, which I'm aware of, and Royal Ascot, which you mentioned. It's the one that people are talking about the most, the one that engages the public the most is definitely the Grand National, which isn't probably a million miles away from where you are now.
No, it's in Liverpool.
Yeah.
Or I think maybe just outside.
Well, I think it's Aintree. I think it's the official.
Yeah, well, I'm going to call that Liverpool just for the... Yeah, so that's fascinating. So Grand National's minimum age is 7. The Triple Crown is for horses, and I use horses advisedly, horses that are 3 years old. And what this means is that these are actually not adult horses. The Triple Crown is a 3-race set for horses that are 3 years old, which means that they are not fully developed, which means they're actually not horses. They are colts or fillies. Fillies can run any of the Triple Crown races, although no filly has won all three. And that has a few ramifications. These are fairly precocious horses. If the Grand National has a minimum of age of 7, that's when a horse is in its prime. So these are horses that are well under that. It means that not all horses that might even become great racehorses are ready at 3. And there's also something, and I don't know if this is just in the U.S., if this is all thoroughbred racing. The way that 3 is calculated actually is just that the official birthday of a thoroughbred horse is January 1st, at least in the U.S. What that means is that a horse who is born later in the year, so let's say February or March, is deemed to turn 1 the following January 1st, whether they actually are one or not. So there are a range of lead up races when a colt or filly is two, and then there's range of lead up races to the Kentucky Derby during the year when they're three. And some of these horses may actually be three, some of them might not. So there's some developmental concerns as well about just how young some of these horses may or may not be.
Yeah, it's actually in the Southern Hemisphere, so like Australia, where there's a bit of another horse racing culture. It's August the 1st.
Oh, interesting. So yes,
they kind of do it as like the middle of the year.
Yeah. Because I think it is something, I'm sure there's something related to winter and when is birthing season or foaling season. So it would make sense that that would be at a different point in the year in the Southern Hemisphere. So what that means is that some of these horses, some of them are quite young, which sort of adds to some of the danger and the difficulty.
You mentioned obviously that the ages, is that part of the reason why it's so difficult? Because a younger horse might just be less consistent and reliable.
A younger horse might be less consistent, less reliable. I think there's also less to go on. I mean, you know, this is, of course, a billion-dollar business, so I mean, this is not a criticism of trainers or those who are involved. But there's a little bit less information to go on about whether a horse can handle this. The other thing I should point out about the three races, so the Kentucky Derby, which is the first and the most important in the U.S. calendar, is a mile and a quarter. The Preakness Stakes is a mile and 3/16, so it is the shortest of the races. And then the Belmont is a mile and a half. So it is the longest of the races. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're actually watching, if you watch a lot of horse racing, you will notice the difference in the Belmont. Like it just feels like a much longer race. Most three-year-old horses will not have run a 1.5 mile race to that point. So the Belmont would be the longest race that they have come to in their career. So again, we're talking very young horses who are, you know, technically colts and fillies and not horses, not stallions or mares. To get very quickly to the stallion point, these are for the most part stallions, but there can be gelded horses. And they sometimes geldings run. Yes, geldings have won one of the races, but no gelding has ever won the Triple Crown. It is considered, and particularly in between 1978 and 2015, considered one of the most difficult feats in all of sport. In the run-up to 2015, there was a lot of talk about, or not just the run-up to 2015, but there was a lot of talk about whether this was ever going to happen again. There were a range of horses that came close. I guess I should pause here and talk a little bit about my connection to this. So I'm a horse racing fan because my parents watched horse racing and we watched it at home. It's pretty common to tune in the television for the Kentucky Derby. It's not that common to be watching, you know, one of the run-up races like the Santa Anita Derby. Like this is just not something people in the U.S. are not, you know, sitting at home in front of the television watching a range of, you know, the Arkansas Stakes and this, that, and the other. But I do sort of imagine that this is kind of one of those really niche sports, particularly if you're watching it a lot and aren't betting on it. So you're not doing this out of that motivation. But yeah, I watched horse racing growing up. And it's one of those sports that, you know, now that I'm an adult, now that I, you know, think a little bit more ethically than I was thinking when I was growing up, it's a sport that's really quite difficult to support in certain ways. You know, the ethical problems of the sport are really serious on a range of issues. I mean, almost every single level of the sport is full of exploitation. I mean, just to start with the horses themselves, listeners might not know that if a horse breaks his or her leg, really in any fashion, that often leads to the putting down of that animal. My understanding of why this is isn't that that is necessarily life-threatening in and of itself, but that the recovery process and the way that horses are anatomically built makes it actually quite difficult for such a large animal to have any sort of quality of life while they are trying to mobilize a leg in an animal that is over 1,000 pounds is really quite difficult. And so infections tend to set in. A lot of times these fractures are compound fractures, they're quite complex. And so there can just be sort of a range of difficulties. Hoof problems tend to roll in if they're immobilized for too long. While the break in of itself isn't immediately life threatening, you start to get into real quality of life issues.
Yeah, and also it's an animal where a lot of the weight, it's a top heavy animal. A lot of the weight's on top. And the legs, which are supporting it, obviously aren't as sturdy.
Precisely, they're quite spindly. Particularly, I think for thoroughbreds that are bred to race, the distribution of weight to quite spindly legs is going to be more exaggerated than you might find in like a quarter horse or something like that. Which isn't to say that quarter horses wouldn't have the same problem, but it's particularly acute in thoroughbred racing. So this means that anytime a horse, the phrase is pulls up. Anytime a horse pulls up or breaks down on a track, that horse is likely going to be put down before they even, in most instances, the horse will be put down at the back of the track or, you know, in some sort of veterinary facility that is attached to the track. So we don't tend to see this a lot in the big draw races, although it has happened in the Triple Crown, which we'll get to in a second. But it does mean that, you know, earlier races, I mean, there have been a few Kentucky Derbies, a few Preakness where earlier races, horses had been put down in undercard races. So there is that sense of, on the one hand, we are told that thoroughbreds, you know, love to run and this is what they would be doing anyway. On the other hand, there's a first and second, they're bred to do this. So, you know, how much of this is, you know, quote unquote, natural desire versus breeding. But at the same time that they're doing that for sport. And the danger involved there basically is their life. So that's one area of really grim exploitation. The second has to do with the jockeys. There are a few issues here. I'm sure listeners have some sense of the general physique of a jockey. There is a weight limit there's a limit of how much weight can be on a horse. It actually differs for fillies. Fillies have a slightly lower weight limit, I think by about 5 pounds. So the Kentucky Derby's weight limit is 126 pounds, and that includes all of the jockey's equipment. So the jockey plus saddle and the jockey's gear. So jockeys weigh generally between 108 and 118 pounds. That means, of course, that most of them are short. There are women jockeys, but this is still a sport that is predominantly, most jockeys are men, I should say. And, you know, that's a pretty low weight for men. It's a fairly low weight for women. So this is one of those sports like you see with say, Olympic wrestling, boxing.
MMA as well, like combat, lots of combat sports where...
For anything that's involving a weigh-in before the event can take place.
Like you hear all kinds of stories in combat sports, in boxing, where with something like the weigh-in and the fighter has had that day, they've just spent the day in a sauna and they've had a couple of glasses of water and that's all they've had.
Yeah. So it's a sport that encourages or requires to some degree some, let's just say, disordered eating practices at the best, as well as the sort of last minute weight loss. And it does mean that this is a sport that has a higher rate of, and it's not talked about that much, but does have a higher rate of anorexia in particular. And of course, because of the sort of gender division, this is again something that's not talked about that much, but it is part of the sport. You have that on the one hand with the jockeys, that they are having to maintain a very low weight. And while they tend to be very, very short, that still can be difficult. But then there's also just the physical danger of what it is that they're doing, because they are sort of perched precariously on top of a very large animal that weighs, you know, at least, you know, 1,200 pounds. And that horse is moving, that, you know, 120 pounds is moving at high speeds, you know, about 40 miles per hour in a pack with anywhere from, you know, 4, 8 to 20 horses moving in a pack that involves jockeying for position up at the rail in particular. Starting involves, you know, being confined in a metal container basically, or in a metal enclosure while the rest of the horses file in, and that's quite a tight space. So this is a sport that involves, for jockeys, a lot of physical danger. They can fall off horses depending on how that fall happens. And of course, they're trained on how to fall, but depending on how that fall happens in a race context, that can be quite grim. Are they falling at the head of a pack? And then are other horses, you know, racing on top of them? I mean, there's, you know, a range of disaster that can occur. If you hear of jockeys who've been in the profession for some time, and it's actually surprising for all of us, it's surprisingly a profession that jockeys can continue for a very long time. Because it's very common for them to be in their 40s and even their few in their 50s. You know, they will have broken maybe the majority of bones in their body at some point. It's not uncommon for there to be very serious back injuries, vertebrae injuries. It's a very dangerous sport.
I actually remember one of the few like jockeys I'm aware of. He's finally retired now, a guy called Tony McCoy, Irish jockey. And he's one of the few that kind of almost had something of a mainstream appeal. And like he finally, as he was coming to his career, he actually won Sports Personality of the Year, which is like our version of the ESPYs. And I remember seeing something in the paper once where there was a picture of him. And they just listed like all the injuries had down the years, and he was like the guy from the game Operation. There was just an arrow pointing to seemingly every part of his body. And even someone like in terms of the danger of just riding a horse. I mean, I think it's someone like Christopher Reeve who was a lot more physically robust than a jockey, and he went over top of a horse and ended up paralyzed for the rest of his life.
And so those horses are not bred to be, you know, sure, jumping horses. They're a little bit more stable in temperament and are bred to be so than racing horses, which are, you know, basically bred to be as quick and as fleet of foot as possible, which also then means that they're often quite triggered. These are horses are very, very highly strung, more so than a show jumping horse would be. So we're talking about, you know, horses, like there's still just an inherent danger to horse riding, period. But here we're talking about three-year-olds who are not yet adult horses, who have been bred to be very highly strong, which means that they fairly routinely can throw jockeys off. There's a lot of talk at the Triple Crown races of what position, say, a particularly notable horse. So there's some horses that really don't like the starting gate. In the starting gate, they're sort of put into this metal enclosure that then springs open when the race begins. And so there's a lot of questions about, in theory, they go in order from one to, you know, whatever it might be. And it can be up to 20 or more. And sometimes there'll be some horses that they put, you know, say a horse is drawn slot two, but is particularly highly strong. You might see that horse sort of being walked around a little bit while other horses go in, just so that it's not sort of rearing up in this very tiny enclosure where there are at least, I think, two people, because there's the jockey and then there's a person who goes in with the jockey and who I think helps release the gate or something. So it's quite a tight space. That's a level of exploitation with the jockeys. It's, you know, again, quite a dangerous sport. And then there's also just the racetrack exploitation, where the majority of the work of making a racetrack or stables run is being done by very poorly paid people, increasingly in the U.S. This is, I think, another one of those industries where you're going to see a lot of undocumented workers. There's been a real increase in the last maybe 10, 20 years in Latino and Latin American jockeys in particular. And so you can sort of tell trends, I think, about what's going on more broadly in the sport by what's happening among the sort of elite jockeys. Because if you're a jockey of a Kentucky Derby horse, you are an elite jockey. So in the last 10 or so years, maybe 10, 20 years, there's been an increase of jockeys who are either Latino or Latin American jockeys. So jockeys from Mexico, Venezuela, et cetera. And I think that symbolizes a much broader trend across the sort of functioning of stables. So the stables workforce is increasingly from Latin America and is increasingly undocumented, which then means that they can be paid particularly poorly. And then there are also a range of jockeys who never make it to the big races, but who nonetheless are almost journeymen. You know, this is a sport that PETA in particular likes to protest. I think always has a campaign around Kentucky Derby Day. I think the sport is not one that, if somebody was asking me to defend the sport, I don't know that I could. And I don't even know that I would necessarily try to. You know, it is one of those sports where it is exploitation. And I think if you like the sport, you kind of have to sit with that. It's certainly not the only sport that's the case for. You know, we do have a situation in which we are talking about animals that don't have any decision-making power in this scenario. But I watch the sport because actually I just love to see the sight of a horse in full flow at the end of a race. I just think it's like one of the best sights in sport. I don't know that I would, you know, suggest that the sport has to exist solely for me, but it's why I still watch the sport. And I think it's probably why so many people who are involved in the sport, the jockeys, the trainers, et cetera, why they're probably still in the sport.
Is it also for you an appeal in terms of watching a sport that it's not just watching an animal in full flow, a horse, but it's obviously a symbiosis of human and animal. You can be a talented jockey, but if you don't have a great relationship with your horse, or vice versa, your ceiling is a lot lower. So when you're seeing greatness in terms of horse racing, you're seeing an incredible, almost like a dance, an incredible symbiosis of two beings.
Yeah, I think for me that's definitely part of it. And seeing how, particularly over the course of a season, seeing how a jockey matches his preferred tactics to the horse's preferred method. So there's a lot of, you know, some horses prefer to be out in front. So some horses don't do well sort of in packs. So they prefer to be out in the front. And then, you know, does the horse have enough to hold off any horses that prefer to conserve some energy and then make a break at the end of it? There's some jockeys who are very comfortable sort of finding those really small spaces. So there's a jockey who's now retired, Calvin Borrell, who is often known as Calvin Borrell because his preferred tactic was to go straight to the rail and then sort of weave his horse through and always find that one moment of an opening at the rail through which he could zoom through.
Yeah, like the rail's on the inside track, basically.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. That's the least amount of distance. So as opposed to going around the pack where you're adding a little bit more distance and a little bit more length, the rail is the shortest distance, but then also has the disadvantage of perhaps you can get trapped. But it's very similar to any sort of track sport. And the problem about being boxed in is, once again, we're talking about 1,200-pound animals. So that issue of being boxed in is one that is quite serious. So over the course of a season, if you're sort of watching those lead-up races and then the Triple Crown, you sort of get this sense of jockeys sort of matching to the style of their horses and figuring out what works best. So I think I was saying a bit ago that there had been this really long gap between the last Triple Crown winner in 1978, affirmed, and then what happened in 2015. And that gap was so long that, in fact, up until 2015, there had not been a Triple Crown winner in my lifetime. And so I had never experienced this. I'd been watching horse racing, I imagine, my whole life. But looking at this list of unsuccessful bids, and I'll get to that in a second, it seems as though I was definitely watching horse racing by 1988, 1989, because I'm remembering some of these names. And I kept hearing, or the one sort of memory I had, was that every time they talked about, you know, the Triple Crown, they would talk about two horses, Secretariat and then Affirmed. And Secretariat, and we mentioned him earlier because, of course, he's very famous. Part of why he's famous is because of what he did at the Belmont Stakes. So the Belmont is the third leg. It is the longest, as I mentioned. And what Secretariat was able to do, he won the Belmont Stakes by 31 lengths. This is probably going to be pretty hard for listeners to imagine, and I would just tell listeners to, you know, find a YouTube clip. But it's really one of those just remarkable things to watch in sport, where you see a horse, or really any athlete who is just so dominant.
Secretariat has opened a 22-length lead. He is going to be the Triple Crown winner. Here comes Secretariat to the wire. An unbelievable, an amazing performance. He hits the finish. Amazing, unbelievable performance by this miracle horse, who owns this most magnificent animal, who has today run the most sensational Belmont Stakes in the history of this race. Secretariat has accomplished the unbelievable task of breaking the mile-and-a-half record by 2 3/5 seconds. That is a record that may stand forever.
31 horses between one horse and first place and second.
Yeah.
You know, it's KE, Ledecky, it's peak Usain Bolt.
Yeah.
2009 era Usain Bolt, where it's like, this person's having one race and everyone else has got a lot of race going on their own. When a camera can't fit first and second place in.
Yeah. Certainly nobody's done, or no horse has done that since. And so it was one of those clips that you always sort of saw of a horse just sort of going away. And so this is why, and we'll get to the stud issue in a moment, but this is in part why there's always a lot of talk about secretariat lineage. So everybody was trying to get, you know, some secretariat lineage in their horses. And I believe actually American Pharoah has some secretariat lineage. And then the other horse that I always heard about growing up was Affirmed. I'm sure most listeners probably haven't heard of Affirmed. You would have to have watched a lot of horse racing to be up to speed on Affirmed. But Affirmed was interesting because Affirmed ran all three races up against the same horse, Alidar, and basically beat out Alidar three times by a nose. It sort of positioned as this great duel between Affirmed and Alidar, and Affirmed was just always, you know, just a nose ahead. And then after that, there were a series of unsuccessful bids, and actually quite a few in the late 90s and early 2000s. When I say unsuccessful bids, that means that they won the Derby and the Preakness and then went to the Belmont. You know, if they'd won the Belmont, they would have won the Triple Crown. So there's a sense of hype that comes if you've won the Derby and the Preakness. So in 1989, Sunday Silence won both and then came in second in the Belmont.
It's Easy Goer with a furlong to the finish in front by five. Sunday Silence appears beaten. The Voyager is third. Down the stretch, and it's Easy Goer with Pat Day winning the Belmont and denying Sunday Silence the Triple Crown.
In 1997, Silver Charm came second in the Belmont.
And down the stretch they come! Three of them in a line! Silver Charm at the rail! Touchbold on the outside! Touchbold puts ahead in front! 50 yards to go! Touchbold! Touchbold wins it by half a length, denying Silver Charm, who finished second, his Triple Crown.
1998, Real Quiet came second in the Belmont after a photo finish.
Down the stretch they come! Real Quiet in front! Here comes Victory Gallop with Gary Stevens! It's Real Quiet to Sorbo, but on the outside, Victory Gallop, too tight to call on the inside. Was it Real Quiet? Did he win the Triple Crown? On the outside, Victory Gallop, neither jockey indicating that they think they won it. That's a photo finish.
And Gary Stevens, who saw his Triple Crown hopes dashed last year by Chris McCarron, is the spoiler today. We'll slow it down. We'll look at it again. But the photo has shown that the nose in front belongs to number 11, and that would be Victory Gallop with a tremendous drive in the stretch.
That must have been savage to lose out.
Yeah, that's brutal. So 1999, Charismatic came in third. 2002, War Emblem came in eighth at the Belmont. 2003, Funny Side came in third in the Belmont. 2004, Smarty Jones. And I remember there was a lot of hype around Smarty Jones. 2004, Smarty Jones came in second in the Belmont.
And Smarty Jones enters the stretch to the roar of 120,000. But Birdstone is going to make him earn it today. The whip is out on Smarty Jones. It's been 26 years. It's just one furlong away. Birdstone is an upside front. They're coming down to the finish. Can Smarty Jones hold on? Here comes Birdstone. Birdstone surges past. Birdstone wins the Belmont Stakes. Smarty Jones was valiant, but vanquished, finishing second. Royal Assault came on to be third. And so this Triple Crown remains vacated for 26 long years. And this magical Triple Crown trail of Smarty Jones comes to a disheartening end in the final strides of the Belmont Stakes.
2008, Big Brown pulled up in the home stretch of the Belmont. 2012, I'll Have Another scratch. Didn't actually ended up not running the Belmont because of an injury. And then 2014, California Chrome came in fourth. So that's a lot of sort of, oh, we might have a Triple Crown. Oh, no. Oh, we might have a Triple Crown. Oh, no. And I think there was both a sense of, in 2015, both a sense of, we've been here before. This probably isn't going to happen. At the same time, though, it might happen. So it's hard to say that it can't happen. But at the same time, you sort of had, you know, you sort of knew not to get too terribly excited.
I mean, I get that thinking, because part of the reason why it's clearly so difficult, not only are you having to run this gauntlet in a short space of time, you win one race, right, go out and do another one, right, go out and do another one, but also you're being up against competitors who've had time to rest. It's almost as if people had planned this to almost stop Triple Crowns happening. It's almost as certain trainers, that they can see a horse that wins the Derby and the Preakness, and they're just almost rubbing their hands like Mr. Burns, saying, right, get the horse ready. He's ready to now fuck this up for the horse that might achieve it in the Belmont.
Right. At the same time, though, particularly if you love the sport, you're also kind of like, I don't want to miss this, though. So it's hard to get too cynical, because then you just don't know what's gonna happen. One of the things that has contributed to this particularly high number of almosts or unsuccessful bids is that one of the things that happens with the three races. So the Kentucky Derby field, you know, some of those horses are more likely to be successful than others. But, you know, there might be two or three horses in that bunch that are real contenders. The Preakness Stakes will start to have some new horses. The Belmont happens three Saturdays after the Preakness. That's the longest race, just to keep in mind. The Preakness would also have very fresh horses. So horses would come in, maybe horses that were seen to be a better bet for that distance would come in fresh. Maybe they had run the Kentucky Derby, but often they hadn't. And so they were coming in fresh, had not had this long grind of two previous races, might be slightly better suited to 1.5 miles, and then would just sort of come in and beat these more tired horses. And there was a lot of brouhaha about this, because this was becoming a common thing, and it was attributed to the reason why there hadn't been a Triple Crown for so long. And in particular, this became a bit of a flashpoint in 2014 when the owner of California Chrome, the horse that came in fourth that year in the Belmont after winning the Derby and the Preakness, that owner was really quite upset in his sort of post-race remarks and said that there would never be another Triple Crown winner unless the only horses at the Belmont were horses that had competed at the Derby and the Preakness.
For have somebody to come up like, this is a coward's way out, in my opinion. This is a coward's way out.
So you think they came right after your horse and that was the plan, just like they have other potential Triple Crowns?
Exactly. Our horse had a target on his back. Everybody else lays out one, or they won't run in the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness. They'll wait until the Belmont. You know what? If you've got a horse, run him in all three. If you've got a horse that can, that Carolyn, if you've got a horse that earns points to run in the Kentucky Derby, those 20 horses that start in Kentucky are the only 20 eligible to run in all three races. This is the coward's way out.
Steve, I know it's a tough loss. We hope to see him down the road. All right, Tom. Obviously, well, strong statements here from the owner of California Chrome, Tom.
Yeah, some bitterness there from Steve Colburn. And, you know, the reason the Triple Crown is so tough is because there are arrested horses that take on the horse that has danced every dance. But
so in 2014, when California Chrome's owner made these remarks, six of the previous eight Belmont winners had not competed in either the Derby or the Preakness. The two that had competed in the Derby and then skipped the Preakness. So we're talking about just a long stint of horses, of Belmont winners. And there's, you know, even if you win the Belmont and you don't win anything else, like, it is prestigious to win the Belmont Stakes. And does a lot for a jockey, for a trainer, and for the owner. You can understand why trainers and owners would put horses into the Belmont that hadn't competed in any of the others. That's a great opportunity for them. But it did seem to really take away from whether from the idea that the Triple Crown was something that could be achieved again.
And I guess in this time as well, it almost gives a slightly most mythical, nearly mystical quality to this. This is a thing that hasn't been done, you know, in your lifetime for like a couple of generations, which makes it not just necessarily unattainable, but also almost fantastical. Like it's part of a, like, it's a plot in a fantasy novel. Like, you know, it's the One Ring or something like that.
So we get to 2015 just to sort of set the stage. No horse had won this since 1978. There was an increasing sense that this could not be won. And it was a combination of this concern about sort of bringing in fresh horses. So I remember reading things that were also kind of like, but questions about whether the thoroughbreds were even being bred to be able to do this sort of long, this long grind. And so we get, you know, to 2015. And one of the things I think is really difficult, you know, even for somebody like me who watches a lot of horse racing, it's a group of three-year-olds each year. There's no real way to tell. I mean, you know, I'm sure for trainers there is, you know, they've been doing this their whole life. But, you know, for lay viewers, there's no real way to tell whether this horse is better than that horse last year, particularly since I'd never seen a Triple Crown in my lifetime. I had nothing to compare it to. So there's no real way to know, oh, this horse is special. Like, what does that mean in the context? The last horse that didn't make it was special. The horse before that, you know, fell at the final hurdle was special. So you hear this X horse is special, X, but, you know, what does that mean? I think one of the other things that happens, even if you are an avid viewer, one of the things that happens because it is this, you know, every single year is a new group of three-year-olds, it means that horses are horses. They're not that easy to tell apart, really. You know, I'm sure they are if you were actually spending a lot of time with them. But, you know, from, you know, watching as a lay viewer, unless there's something very distinct, you know, distinguishing, you know, sometimes they'll have certain kinds of like spots on the forelock or something like that, or they might be a very distinctive color. Most of these horses are brown, black, hard to really distinguish. So there's nothing that's really drawing you to a particular animal, which means that what you do end up tracking if you follow a lot of horse racing is that you're not so much following the animals year on year, in part because you can't because they're only three-year-olds. What you are following are the jockeys. And you're following the trainers. I've been watching, you know, since the late 80s. And so there are a series of trainers whose names I know and whose faces I mostly recognize. And the same is actually particularly true with jockeys. There's a range of jockeys who I know, some of whose voices I know just from hearing them. That's sort of how you follow the sport in a way, is by following the trainers and the jockeys. So 2015, we have the horse American Pharoah. Great name. American Pharoah was trained by Bob Baffert, and Bob Baffert is one of the trainers that had been having quite a great career prior to this, but it was somebody who I had been, you know, quote unquote following, as in he was in the group of players every single year for maybe the last 10 to 15 years.
Like a coach always gets their team to the playoffs like every season.
Right.
And maybe had a couple of championships.
Right. So often there, I think he had won one of every. He'd won a Derby, he'd won a Preakness, he'd won a Belmont, I think.
Yeah, but never all at the same time.
Never all at the same time. So he was in that group of elite trainers, because if you win one of these, you are an elite trainer, but then, of course, had not won the Triple Crown. So Bob Baffert's horses have won 5 Kentucky Derbies, 7 Preakness Stakes, 3 Belmont Stakes, and then 3 Kentucky Oaks. And the Kentucky Oak is the premier race for fillies.
Which I think most people know, but if not, that's a female horse, isn't it? A filly.
That is a female that's not reached maturity. So colt would be when we're talking about these 3-year-olds, so they're not adult horses. So they're referred to as colts. And when they become adult horses, they would be known as stallions, unless they had been gelded, by which, just for viewers who might not know, by which I mean neutered, which is not that common in thoroughbred racing. Fillies are the young female horses who would become mares when they reach adulthood. So Bob Baffert was one to follow, and, you know, the person that if you'd been following horse racing for a decent amount of time, you would have known who he was. And then we have Victor Espinoza, who I'm pretty sure I would have known who he was at the time. Victor Espinoza was sort of up and coming, because he's been in the profession for a while, but he wasn't somebody I had known a lot about. Necessarily.
And like you say, about a lot more Latinx jockeys in the sport. Like, he was born in Mexico.
I should say, he had won the Kentucky Derby previously. He had ridden War Emblem, and he had been on California Chrome the year before. So the horse that did the Derby and the Preakness, he had been the jockey for that horse as well. So again, somebody who's at the top of his field. I went back to these events, to watching clips of these on YouTube. You know, I think it's interesting to do this for listeners. You kind of don't really get a sense of what's going on until you watch, and they're not that long. And they also have some of the best commentators. There's sort of a combination of almost like auction house patter. They have to talk very, very quickly to get through a range of horse names, and often quite awkward horse names.
Back when we used to have kind of very specific commentators for each sport, a guy that did horse racing on pairs, a guy called Peter O'Sullivan, and people could always, he was commented to impersonations of him, where you're just, almost speak, sounds like you're speaking in tongues because it sounded like you've never taken a breath.
Yeah.
It was just like one long sentence, and maybe you can pick out a name of a horse in there. Because you're right, you have to call so much information in such a short space of time, particularly like in the final, you know, final furlong or something.
Because what you're tracking is you're both A, just giving a sense of the lay of the land, so where are horses, but that could be quite fast changing, particularly up at the front. There's usually at the very beginning before things get too serious, there's usually a sort of almost like a mapping out of where every single horse is. But if that's 20 horses, and sometimes it is 20 horses, that's a lot of work that you have to get through quickly, so that if things are shifting up at the front, because sometimes those early moves could be quite significant. It is worth listening to, and I would say particularly the NBC commentators, there are a few clips around that are just sort of the track people, and they're fine, whatever. But the NBC commentators, I mean, these people basically, or this person, I think it's Tom somebody at this point, but I could be wrong. Basically, they get 3 days a year to shine. So it's worth listening to them for that point. Horse racing commentating is some of the best in the business. I think it's also interesting to watch because you get a sense of just how many tactics there are. You get a sense of the different terrain. So one of the things that distinguishes the Triple Crown, the U.S. Triple Crown, from, say, European horse racing, in particular U.K. horse racing, is that it happens on a dirt track and not a turf track, which has some real ramifications for weather, which we'll get to with the Preakness. And so when I was watching American Pharoah, just watching some clips of the Kentucky Derby, because year on year it's a different group of horses, you don't really remember, or I don't necessarily remember, how these races were won, with the exception of Secretariat. So it was interesting to watch, and I was surprised to see that American Pharoah in the Kentucky Derby, A, had to swing to the outside to get into good position. It's not unusual necessarily, but it's not especially usual, particularly for favorite.
And inherently more difficult because it's, you're having to cover more ground. And you said American Pharoah, like, he went into this as the favorite, so he wasn't like a massive shock. Who's this horse? Came from nowhere. I mean, people were looking at him beforehand.
So he came from the outside, which means you're also, again, moving, not just is that more space, you're moving around quite wide, because I think he went around two or three horses to the outside. So those horses are continuing to move forward while this horse is moving to the outside. And in watching it, I was quite struck by the fact that he did not have that race in hand up until relatively late, which I think is, again, why it's useful to watch. So there was a very late surge, or a late surge towards the end, and then the race was won.
And they're into the stretch, and it's American Pharoah who has taken the lead on the outside. In between horses, it's firing line. Dorfman is down at the rail as they come into the final furlong. American Pharoah, firing line, not done yet. And these two come into the final 16th. It's American Pharoah in front, firing line. Dorfman is third.
One of the things that's interesting about all of these, these are very sort of formal events. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance. There is certain songs that are sung. I would say maybe about half an hour before the actual post time. So the post time is the moment that the gate is supposed to be released. 30 minutes before that, there's a beginning of a lot of ceremony. There'll be the formal riders up, which involves a very formal call or yell from the track steward. Then there is some bugling that happens, again, very formal, but there are a range of state / track or / city track anthems. So the most famous one is My Old Kentucky Home, which is quite a nice tune, I have to admit, but we just learned recently, not so great.
Is it basically a little bit Confederate?
I think it is a little bit Confederate, although Kentucky is an interesting state in that regard. There was an article that went around about it that I'm now blanking on some of the specific details, but I think there was an attempt of positioning itself as an enslaved person's memory of Kentucky. I mean, it's not great. When the race is won, the horse that wins the race is the Kentucky Derby is draped in a bed of roses. because we know that that really matters to the horse, we know, to be draped in the bed of roses. The Preakness involves Maryland by Maryland, and then that is a bed, or a blanket, I should say, of black-eyed Susans. And then the Belmont Song is New York, New York, which usually involves some sort of Broadway star. Liza Minnelli has done it a few times. And then the blanket is a blanket of carnations. These quite sort of dramatic cultural situations. So American Pharoah wins the Derby. The Preakness, which happens 2 weeks later, I had forgotten entirely the weather conditions that, that took place with the Preakness. It was very, very heavy rain, which then, because this is a dirt track and not a turf track, means that this is mud. So if you watch, and I again would recommend that listeners find a clip of this, you're basically watching horses running through thick slop and mud, which of course brings its own dangers. Pretty much any time you see a race that is in those kinds of heavy conditions, the jockeys will usually have two, maybe even three goggles that they sort of layer on top of their helmet. And then as one gets completely covered in mud, they slip it down, pull down the next. So that by the end of the race, they may have sort of two goggles sort of dangling, completely dirty, dangling, you know, sort of around their neck.
Well, just also in terms of that specific race of Preakness, that a horse is basically racing through mud.
Yeah.
It's the same for every horse. But in terms of what American Pharoah's trying to do, he's still got one more race after this. And you would imagine that these kind of conditions take a lot out of a horse.
Whereas any horse that sort of rolls into the Belmont fresh will not have had that situation. So they were, you know, they were back home chilling on hay while American Pharoah was slogging through mud for a mile and 3 3/16. In this race, American Pharoah once again runs to the outside, but gets to the front relatively early on. So he leads not quite from the beginning, but he gets there earlier than he got there for the Kentucky Derby. But he doesn't really pull away until later in the race. So there's still a sense that there are horses that are with him, and that are sort of pushing him up until sort of the final moment of the race. But he does win. And so then we go into the Belmont again with the sense of, okay, so this could happen.
But like we've been here before.
We've been here before. Is it going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I will actually say, though, I forgot to mention that I briefly researched this, that Victor Espinosa, the jockey, he actually said after the Kentucky Derby when American Pharoah won that, he said then he felt the Triple Crown could be on the table, because he said after he'd, you know, won the race, gone through the tape, he tried to pull the horse up to slow it down, and American Pharoah weren't slowing down. He kept going, and Espinosa was like, oh, he doesn't seem tired. He's run this race, he's from the outside, has won it, and doesn't look like he's running out of gas. Maybe this could happen. And I'm sure he thought that was confirmed even more after he won the Preakness in those conditions.
Again, far be it from me to make any judgments based on, you know, about whether he was right to think that or not. It is one of those things where it is just sort of, again, difficult, because we probably heard him say something similar the year before with California Chrome. I'm not trying to suggest that that wasn't a genuine belief on his part. You do start to hear these things. It's a special horse. He just has it. He's always had it, you know, these kinds of things. So, again, it's hard to know whether to get excited, whether to not get excited, you know.
I'm more as sure as we go to the Belmont as well, in terms of media hype and hype from horse racing fans, and it's now, it may be tentative embracing of the occasion, but it's still an embrace of, whoa, he just needs to win one race. Ultimately, whatever has happened in the past, however difficult this has been, hasn't happened for, like, you know, 3 decades. He just needs to win one race.
And I think particularly for media, there's no not playing it up, because then if you don't play it up and a horse wins a Triple Crown, well, where were you?
The whole point of the media is to engage as many people as they can. So they'll always try and make something seem exciting, even if it's not warranted.
Particularly for that third race, the Belmont, if there's no horse that could potentially win the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes is only being watched by very serious horse racing fans or people who are betting on the race. If a horse is in position to potentially win the Triple Crown, then you have just a much wider viewing audience. You know, in terms of the finances for media companies, et cetera, you know, advertising, you know, all of that, it really matters to get that hype up, because that is a way of perhaps even keeping the sport a live on broadcast television, because currently it's on broadcast television.
I think of the Tiger effect on golf, the Usain Bolt effect on athletics, even in terms of like women's tennis. The longer Serena stays in, the better it is for CBS.
So we get to the Belmont, weather is better. And this race was a slightly different one for American Pharoah. He got the lead very, very quickly. Didn't have to run to the outside to do it. So that's some energy conserved, which is important for a race this long. Was pressed most of the way. So he doesn't, you know, he doesn't sort of build up a decisive lead too early on. But then he does manage to kick away in that final stretch. He's clearly pulling away. Is clearly going to win. There comes a point where it's clear that he is going to win the Triple Crown. And then again, the announcer gets very, very dramatic with the language. It becomes clear that this is going to happen early enough that he can sort of get in the full drama and the full ramp up, you know, right as he crosses the line.
And they're into the stretch, and American Pharoah makes his run for glory as they come into the final furlong. Frosted is second with 1/8 of a mile to go. American Pharoah's got a 2-length lead. Frosted is all out at the 16th pole, and here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
He can basically deliver the speech that he'd probably penciled in since American Pharoah won the Preakness. Maybe his whole career. It's weird to think it was Andrew Castle who did it, but Andrew Castle was the guy that got to call a man winning the Wimbledon singles title.
Yeah.
But I'm sure he'd had an idea of what he wanted to say. Like, I'm sure there are football commentators who are like, well, if England did win the Men's World Cup, mm-hmm. what would the line be at the final whistle? So for that, read this.
And sometimes with horse racing, like if it's a photo finish, you actually can't get these lines in dramatic fashion as the horse's nose crosses the line because you're so busy trying to figure out if the horse has even won. So there can be no time, but this sort of worked out perfectly so that there was enough time to get out all of those lines in very dramatic fashion. And I have to say, you know, again, getting back to that question of, you know, why do I watch the sport? Even watching it back now, knowing the outcome, I found myself tearing up just at that moment of American Pharoah crossing the line. That is in spite of the fact that a horse won the Triple Crown this year. So Justify won the Triple Crown this year. Same trainer, Bob Baffert, which is in part why I mentioned Bob Baffert. He's now one of two trainers ever to have trained two Triple Crown horses.
And they're into the stretch. Justify comes roaring home to a raucous Belmont Park with one furlong to run. Gronkowski and Hofberg trying to run him down. Vino Rosso is fourth, a 16th to go. Justify is still there. Justify from Gronkowski. He's just perfect, and now he's just immortal. Justify is the 13th Triple Crown winner. Gronkowski was second. Hofberg was third, and Vino Rosso was fourth.
This is now something that, you know, I don't want to say it's becoming, you know, common or regular, but even the fact that I just saw a horse do this, I still found myself completely overcome just at the sight of this. Like, there's just something so magnificent about the accomplishment. And I think also, you know, for me personally, so, and I don't mind sharing this, my father was still alive when American Pharoah won the Triple Crown. And he was ill, but he was still alive. And so I called my father pretty much the second that American Pharoah crossed the line, just to have that moment of like, oh, look at this really amazing thing that we have sort of been following certainly my whole lifetime. And look, it's finally happened. And I remember, I think I tweeted something along these lines that the last Triple Crown, both of my parents had watched, and I had not been alive for it. This Triple Crown, 2015, my mother had passed away, but my father and I were still around. And then I was like, and you know, in all likelihood, the next Triple Crown will happen with just me around. So that this sort of moment in my family of this thing that we do is sort of marked, you know, by these moments of accomplishment with the Triple Crown. This is kind of why we're watching the sport. And I can sort of mark the passage of time and passing away of my family by this event. And that is what transpired. 2015, my father was alive. In 2018, my father was not alive. And so I sort of, again, you know, a few months ago, had that sort of really reflective moment about what happened.
Sport can do that. Not specifically like your specific experience. It can not just mark in a passage of time, because I can mark passage of time through Premier League seasons and World Cups, European Championships, but also how it's a link between normally older and younger relatives. I think Jonathan's mentioned it, but like he's quite a big cycling guy, and I think part of the reason is that his uncle used to come around when he was a kid and they watched Tour de France every summer, which ignited his personal love of cycling.
I think one of the other sports you see this a lot with is boxing, actually, which in the US is really fading fast as a popular sport. I don't particularly like boxing, but my parents watched a lot of boxing. I never really got into it in the same way, but I think it's pretty common in the US to have, again, African-American families who, you know, where they grew, people grew up watching boxing because their parents watched boxing, and now they're the only ones who are still watching boxing, which is really struggling in the US. So to tie up a little bit with American Pharoah, and actually just sort of cycle back around to the exploitation question. So American Pharoah, you know, one of the things that happens when a horse wins the Triple Crown, I mean, actually when any horse wins any of these events, but particularly the Triple Crown, is that the horse's value to its owners in particular is quite tied up with its, a filly has never won the Triple Crown. So it would be interesting to see how that transpired. But a colt's value then quickly very much becomes getting him out to stud. And what that means, for listeners who might not be familiar, is that basically the horse just spends the rest of his life being bred, basically. I mean, it's very clinical, but it basically involves just his having sex with mares for the rest of his life.
Basically just trying to impregnate them, or like you were saying, with Secretariat, spread his seed so that it can breed more, like almost super racehorses.
So, you know, if we go back to that question of horse injury, owners generally make very, very quick calculations that they are not interested in risking injury, and they are interested in maximizing stud fees. I don't know that much about this, but, you know, it is a fee per act, let's just say. And we're talking, you know, large, large sums of money for the owners. So American Pharoah ran a few more races. Ran the Breeders' Cup Classic. The Breeders' Cup Classic, while not the most famous race in the U.S., I think you have to be very interested in horse racing to watch the Breeders' Cup Classic, but it is, in terms of importance and form, it is sort of more equivalent to the Grand National.
The one in 2015 that you're about to talk about is also American Pharoah competed in that. And I mean, the curious thing was I saw some footage of the Breeders' Cup that year, and they spent most of the footage just talking about American Pharoah and the Triple Crown rather than the Breeders' Cup itself.
I think that, again, would have maybe gotten us, you know, I don't know the actual figures, but it probably would have had a slightly higher rate of viewers than the Breeders' Cup Classic typically would. Again, it's not a race that people are paying attention to unless you really enjoy horse racing, but it is the most important, and its qualification is 3 years old and up, so it is not for colts. So that's why I say it's more equivalent to the Grand National.
And I think maybe the television was happy, coverage of the Breeders' Cup, were very happy that America Fair is competing, because they so much spoke about the Triple Crown as much of watch the Breeders' Cup, because like, yeah, you missed Belmont, you missed Triple Crown, well, you get to see him maybe one last time go in the Breeders' Cup.
So American Pharoah won, which means he is the only horse to have won the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup Classic. He won by a significant margin, 6.5 lengths, which is the largest tie for the largest margin in the history of the event.
And they're into the stretch, and American Pharoah has a 4-length lead. Advance is second, and then it's Flashton, Totalist, and Honor Code. American Pharoah comes into his final furlong, and he's got a 5-6 length lead as they come to the wire. A Triple Crown winner, a Breeders' Cup winner, a horse of a lifetime. American Pharoah has won the Breeders' Cup Classic over FNX and Honor Code in a final time of 2:07. He went out in style.
And then he very quickly was retired.
Which is part of why he was the first. Incredibly impressive. Like, I don't think many horses would have done it, but the ones that have won a Triple Crown is like, right, retired that horse now.
Because again, you know, to get the risk here is every time a horse runs, there is a risk that they might damage themselves or break a leg in particular and then be put down. And while I think trainers and jockeys would view that as a real personal tragedy, for owners, that's an economic situation that they're not willing to risk.
It's like what you're saying about studs, people paying. If you own a mare and you want American Pharoah to impregnate it, then it's a case of you only need to pay up. But it's an investment because it might be worth it because the offspring may then become a great horse race, which you can then own and make a shitload of cash off. I remember at the time when he won the Belmont, that he was trending. I think the number one trend worldwide, which thought that sounded like, I assumed it was either the name of a film, which I hadn't heard about, or like more likely, it's like, oh, it's the name of, you know, Drake's new album or something, or Jay-Z's new album or something. That's kind of what I assumed. And then after a while, you realize, oh, this is a horse race, and like the Triple Crown. And obviously, at the time, I didn't know anything about the Triple Crown, not a thing. I hadn't even heard of it. But the fact is, like, he was training worldwide for a reason. This was a very unique and kind of monumental, even though if it's in a kind of a minority sports. I think niche sport is probably the right word, because it's one of those sports. I'm not sure, horse racing, that not most many people know about it or even like it, but those who do really do
those
like
who
it.
Do really do like it and know a lot about it. But it's also one of those sports that is kind of, you know, can be in the background a little bit. So you can have a Kentucky Derby party, and it's almost like a New Year's Eve party where you only have to have the television on for like half a second to watch the ball drop or the fireworks or whatever it is. And so you can have a social event around this and actually be paying no attention whatsoever to the event in question.
In some respect, like the Super Bowl. I mean, when I say event, I mean as it pulls people in that may not be fans of the actual sport itself.
I don't think I've actually ever been to a Kentucky Derby party, but I can imagine one happening in which actually the race itself is missed entirely. It's such a niche sport that, like, you could imagine people, you know, out in the backyard barbecuing, not sure of when this thing is going to happen anyway, and, you know, what does it really matter?
The only other key story from the whole American Pharoah story, and I put on my notes, I just have the word Serena in capital letters because of the sub-storyline that happened towards the end of 2015.
Although, started up, I would say started up right after this. I think there was some back and forth between you and I on Twitter. Serena was already, it was already clear that this was going to be just an excellent, excellent year for her. And there was already some question about, like, was the horse going to win Sports Person of the Year for Sports Illustrated, or was it going to be Serena? And I had said that it was going to be the horse. And I think you were a little horrified. And then this sort of took off more towards the end of the year, which I'll let you get into.
As I explained earlier, I had no idea of the significance of this. And we spoke about it when we reviewed the year in 2015. So that podcast exists in our archives. This probably was maybe the greatest year Serena Williams' career. At one point in the year, held all four slams, won the Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon, looked like she was going to win the US Open, got knocked out in the semi-finals, but still won three slams in the year, got to the semis of the other. Her win-loss record for the year was 53-3. She only lost three matches over an entire calendar year. That was far and away the world number one. So that felt just unassailable as an achievement. Now, I say this, obviously not definitely at that time understanding what... I didn't know what a Triple Crown was.
I think I literally said that on Twitter. And you were shrugging, like, whatever. Yeah,
and I'm just like, and? I don't know what that is. Also, because the Triple Crown is a thing that exists in rugby union in the Six Nations, which is a lot less prestigious, let's shall we call it. It's just basically one of the home nations beats all the other home nations. But you can win the Triple Crown and not win a tournament. It's like if England beats Scotland, Ireland, and Wales.
Yeah, that's not...
You might still have lost to Italy and France. That's my only point of reference for the phrase Triple Crown. And for me, a Triple Crown might just be a singular trophy for all I knew at the time. As we've just spoken about now, it's a big deal. But at the time, it wasn't even like I had some personal beef against American Pharoah or even against horse racing. It was just, I didn't see how anything could even get close to what Serena had done. And I think probably a lot of people, in terms of what we're about to talk about, had any understanding of what American Pharoah had achieved. Then it grew into a massive online firestorm as we got to the end of the year. And was it Sports Illustrated put kind of like a Twitter poll out of who should be sports person of the year? And I think the clear majority winner from people online or people who voted on their website was American Pharoah. And that got picked up and became a story of Sports Illustrated being anti-Serena, being anti-black women, they're misogynoiristic, they're, this is kind of everyone's against Serena kind of thing. We're getting to the point where you want to deny Serena's achievement so much that mm-hmm. you'll pick a horse, an animal, over her, which has its own connotations, I think, is because obviously black people historically being compared to animals, black women being treated like animals in things like, you know, the slave trade and stuff. And
mm-hmm. also very specifically with Serena's own history of the way that some commentators have spoken about her and her physique very specifically, which is something that in certain ways has hit her worse than Venus, just because of the differences in their physique.
Yeah, because she's just more discernibly muscular than Venus. Yeah, Venus sometimes gets called graceful. No one has ever called Serena graceful.
Right.
Black Twitter was pissed. They were pissed. The viewers actually didn't get the decision. I think this was just a what do the viewers think. But the Sports Illustrated editors made the final call, and they gave their award to Serena. And Serena did make a point of throwing a bit of shade towards American Pharoah in her acceptance speech.
I've had my shares of ups and downs. I've had many struggles. I've had blood clots in both my lungs at the same time, and I lived through tragedies and controversies and horses. I had to say it. Basically, you know, I've been through it all. I'm also a part-time comedian.
It did become a serious online story at the time, and I do think, look, a lot of these people complaining are just Serena fans. Like, I think there's more Serena fans on the planet than tennis fans. And a lot of people who talk about Serena know fuck all about tennis. Now, you and I are two of the people who fit in the middle of that Venn diagram. There are people who love both, but we also love the sport. So this wasn't a case of talking Serena up for her because we just like her. She had you lose 3 matches in a year with 3 slams. I mean, I think we both think Sports Illustrated made the right decision. But what I think has to be acknowledged, you know, with the benefit of distance and time, is that there was a conversation to be had. I think maybe part of the issue as well is that just the simple nomenclature of sports person, and then you give it to a horse.
I don't know when in the year it was, but you and I definitely went back and forth and was like, yeah, it's going to be the horse. And obviously I was doing that it must have been early in the summer. So I think I would imagine that we were having that conversation before Wimbledon. And I was convinced it was going to be the horse for a few reasons. A, I knew what the Triple Crown was. I knew that we'd waited 37 years for one, sort of knew all the specifics. But also, I think Sports Illustrated has not been particularly interested in paying attention to tennis and what has been happening in tennis over the past decade or so. Let me be clear, I'm not suggesting that 2015 was one of those years. But there have been years where Roger Federer or Rafa Nadal should have, without question, been at the very least in the final two. And Sports Illustrated is just not interested in tennis in that fashion. And doesn't really, I think, have a clear sense of, I mean, I don't know their internal processes for determining this stuff, but they don't really seem to understand what 53-3 means versus what it means for Tom Brady to be in the conversation. And that's not really a knock on Tom Brady. These are, of course, different sports that they're trying to determine, but they are different. You know, some of these sports have team members. And some of these sports are individual combat without coaching, going on for hours and hours and hours. So I was sort of in the school of, first of all, it's a Triple Crown. This has not happened, you know, in almost 40 years. And second, Sports Illustrated tends not to pay that much attention to tennis. And I think we're clear, had this not been an American woman, had this not been one of the Williams sisters, had it been somebody else who had had this good a year.
Yeah, had it been Garbina McGruth, had it been Angie Kerber. It's sometimes throughout the course of the year, I mean, this conversation happens over here in regards to sports personality of the year,
yeah,
that sometimes an event will happen, and it can happen in March, and it's like, right, there's your sports personality winner, and you know. When Andy Murray won Wimbledon for the first time, bookies stopped taking bets now. And I can understand knowing, obviously, what, and hopefully our listeners will understand, knowing what we know now about the Triple Crown, is that when that moment when America fell across the line, you're like, well, nothing's beating that. You think you've already seen.
Right.
But obviously that's in the summer. There's still more years to go. There were still things that could happen. Serena's never had a year like that since.
I would also say that in the same way that I think a lot of Serena fans are Serena fans and not tennis fans, I think a lot of people who probably just easily clicked American Pharoah in that poll. Are they horse racing fans? They're probably not. They're probably people who are like, oh, this is cool.
Also, I mean, because like we should analyze all parts of the conversation, because we mentioned that vote was a reader's vote. There's also a lot of people there who probably just don't like Serena. It reminds me a little bit of the BBC rater they had during the World Cup and how Raheem Sterling's average over the World Cup was 4.9.
Despite people having to go to great lengths to describe how he was, in fact, opening up space for various other opportunities.
But the thing is,
it's not about that.
And it was so much lower than everyone else and every other player. And it's like, well, we know what's going on. This isn't an accident. Apparently, like, I just heard anecdotal stories of people in pubs watching matches just shouting abuse at Sterling.
As did I, yeah.
So it's that kind of thing of, you just don't like her. So this is why you're voting for this horse who you probably never even heard of, but you think it's got a cool name.
You maybe watched the Derby. Maybe you happened to turn the television on at 6:30 p.m. on the day of the Belmont, and then you got a little excited. You know, I think you're right. We both agree that it was right for her to win, in part because of the tremendous year that she had. And also because I think the Sports Illustrated really cannot be in the business of choosing an animal over a Black woman who has had a tremendous year, particularly given what you've just said, which is that so many of the people who were voting for the horse probably knew nothing really about it. And we're not voting on that based on the legitimate athletic accomplishment that was, but just can't be bought, you know, are so uninterested in accepting Serena Williams as, you know, the amazing sports person that she is. So in that context, you know, sometimes decisions just have to get made. And the right one here was Serena Williams. I think, and I hope this is what we've accomplished in the podcast, is to get a sense, not so much of reopening that debate, but to at least have a sense of why that was a legitimate accomplishment and why that was even a discussion among serious people. And by serious people, I mean people who are, you know, tennis fans, people who watch horse racing, people up to speed on both. Why that was a serious conversation, and that to have that conversation was not to downplay Serena's accomplishments, even though some of the people who would have supported American Pharoah's winning that award were certainly doing that. There is a legitimate case there that is unfortunately being, you know, clouded up in a lot of Serena hate.
Yeah, and it's the kind of issue with awards, like generally speaking, and it's something that I've grown increasingly tired with, and this isn't a screed against identity politics, but this is the problem that happens when people analyze things just through identity politics. So just through as a Black woman, as a gay man, as a disabled non-binary person, as a Muslim, as a this. So in terms of Serena being a Black woman, it's like, well, we need the Black woman to win because she's a Black woman. Now, Serena is not just some Black woman. Serena is an all-timer, probably the finest to ever swing a racket, and had a year that I just think is pretty almost unmatched. Like, don't expect to see her or anyone else go through a year picking up 3 slams and winning 53 matches and only losing 3.
Although we keep saying this, and now I just feel like I have to turn to, what was that 2008 record for Rafa? French Wimbledon and the Olympics. So basically, with the exception of the Australian Open, he had the French Wimbledon, the Olympics, but he does have a lower percentage, 82-11, which is 88% versus 94%.
The thing about Serena, it's not that she won 53, she lost 3.
Mm-hmm.
She got an entire calendar year and lose 3 matches. So that achievement is epic. The problem is, when you're so invested singularly, almost monomaniacally invested in this person, it then you get almost solipsistic, and it's like you fade everything else out around it, and everything else around it is insignificant. And that's the thing I have a problem with. You can acknowledge something as great. Well, I mean, Serena's year was better than great, but you can acknowledge that year as special, and also acknowledge other things are really good or great or special too. So it's the Moonlight La La Land conversation. Mm. Where Moonlight, for my mind, was a much superior film. Deservedly won Best Picture. But the problem is, it became a battle where you had to draw battle lines and be behind one team or another. And the more you spoke about Moonlight being great, the more La La Land was apparently garbage. And it's like, no, La La Land was a really good film. I don't think it was as good as Moonlight at all. Some might disagree. But you can say one is good without saying everything else is shit.
Mm.
And look at this through these narrow straight lines and these binaries. Like, La La Land was a good film. The years that Beyoncé hasn't won album and yet the Grammys, which again I disagree with. But I remember the year that Beck beat her, and all of a sudden, who is Beck is trending. I'm like, just stop, yeah? I have no problem with you saying Beyonce should have won, and I agree with that. But the idea that Beck is just like some random nobody musician, it's just like, no, just stop. Like, you lose all credibility, you lose all credibility, and I no longer listen to your argument, because to act like Beck is nobody is bullshit. It means you just don't know much about music. The year when Adele won, again, and to be fair, Adele gave Beyonce props at her acceptance speech. Beyonce had the superior piece of work. That didn't mean that Adele's work was also not very good. And one's victory doesn't have to diminish the quality of others. So as far as like Serena American Pharoah goes, you know, to bring this all back to the point, American Pharoah's incredible success doesn't, in my mind, diminish Serena's, or vice versa. And if you think it is, then I have to ask what your reasoning is for that, because it makes zero sense. And it's happening more and more now, and I get it, because you don't get this education in life generally unless you're very fortunate. So you get this education on social media, and social media has nailed its colours to that ID politics flag so much that people now only see things through that prism, and it means your arguments are seriously lacking. And the other point is, we're not trying to depoliticise sport or say, just like great sport no matter what, and everyone's the same. Bullshit. Definitely analyse it through a prism of like race, gender, sexuality, a combination of these things. But yeah, there was a dispiriting need to lift Serena up at the expense of others. And apart from anything else, I don't think Serena really needs us to do that.
No.
She's fine. She won 53 matches and lost 3 and won 3 Grand Slams. I don't think she needed PR. PR wasn't the issue here.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned, she won the award. But it was a year when, as a sports fan, I think it's great that 2015 was the year where two epic things happened. With American Pharoah's Triple Crown being one of them.
Yeah. The thing that's fascinating about this is, I think you're right to point out, you know, does she really, you know, not so much does she need the award, but like, she doesn't need us finding her corner in this particular way. And what I think is particularly interesting is that it's not as though this is translated to, I think, what the real battle is, which is to get the sport of tennis to accept her as the best person playing right now.
In terms of consensus, that will still go to Roger Federer.
I think it's shifting, but it's taking a long time, and it depends on who you talk to.
It does depend on who you talk to, but I think broadly, as a straw poll, I think Roger Federer, and in part, and there's a conversation to be had, by the way. Unlike some of Black's, I do think there's a conversation to be had in terms of if you were, not as a one-to-one comparison, because they compete in different genders, but as broad achievements, I think there's a conversation to be had. However, the reason why I think, as with most of these things, why broadly people would say Federer is because people like him.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think the grounds on which to have that conversation, I do think there are grounds to have that conversation in terms of competition and quality of competition, which isn't to suggest that Serena has just been blowing past no names, because that's most certainly not what has happened. You know, so if you're going to have that conversation, I think that's the ground that one has that conversation on, is was there the equivalent of Rafa and Djokovic? On the other hand, though, it just, you know, how important is it to have that comparison?
I think it's a fun comparison. Like, you're coming at it in a, it's not the biggest deal in the world.
Yeah.
And it's a fun pub conversation. And you're coming at it through,
from some deep knowledge about both parts of the sport.
Yeah, about the sport and also about the history of the sport. So you have to acknowledge things like male privilege and misogyny as well.
Mm-hmm.
No, like, Roger Federer is not amazing because he's white.
Right.
Yeah. You know.
Or because he like wears, you know, cream vests on the courts of Wimbledon. But that is what is feeding into this idea.
Yeah, idea of partly people liking him. So yeah, everyone, just try and broaden your analysis with sport, or maybe just don't talk about it. We'll be back in around a month. Until then.